Welcome, gentle listener, to Still Dreaming, a podcast about existentialism and forever night. Forever Night was episodic, but this podcast kind of isn't. You may be best served starting at the beginning with the introduction and working your way forward. So with that, let's begin. Welcome, everyone. This week, the title of our episode is I Will Repay, and this seems to be a reference to a line from the two-part pilot. When Nick was fighting with Lacroix, Lacroix says to Nick, I made you a god, just before Nick stabs him through with a metal spike. Nick replies to him, I will repay you. So, does this mean Lacroix is coming back? Let's find out. This episode was directed by Jorge Montesi and written by Brad Wright, who also wrote Last Act, by the way, and it originally aired on September 15th, 1992. The synopsis, as always, taken from Wikipedia, tells us this. When Natalie's brother, a city prosecutor, is shot by a captured suspect at the police station, Natalie pleads with Nick to make him a vampire to save his life. Meanwhile, Nick remembers an incident in an English fishing village centuries ago where he faced a similar dilemma when he rescued a dying leper woman. So, the synopsis in this one kind of gives it away. Once you know the premise, you kind of know what's going to happen. And the episode doesn't really deviate from what you think is going to happen. Now, I should mention that this episode is a fan favorite, and it should be. I'll tell you up front, it's a good episode. I had a hard time taking notes because I just wanted to watch it. So tonight, we'll also be returning to an author we've looked at very briefly in a previous episode, Simone de Beauvoir. She lived from 1908 until 1986, and I discussed some of her ideas on the problem of vengeance in Episode 8. This week, we return to her works, particularly The Ethics of Ambiguity, written in 1947, from which we'll be examining the relationship of the self to others, existential ethics, and the question of how I can be both radically free and tied to others. So with this in mind, let's get started. In our opening, we see a good-looking guy in a suit on a big-ass mobile phone trying to call Natalie. His car is broken down. Natalie arrives, and there's some nice banter. This, of course, is Natalie's brother, and he's in a hurry. It's the middle of the night, it seems. Down at the station, Skanky is listening to some perp named Craven go on and on about how he's innocent, and then he saunters out with his lawyers. It seems like a busy day at the station, lots of arrests and action. Skanky and Nick are talking to a woman who has testimony against this Craven guy. She wants immunity in writing from the prosecutor. I presume that's Natalie's brother. Meanwhile, cops are having a hard time controlling an unruly perp in the adjoining area. Suddenly, the perp wrests himself away from the arresting officer, grabs the guy's gun, and starts shooting. Nick rushes in and tries to talk the guy down, but Nat and her brother Richard are just arriving outside. And you know where this is going. Yep, Richard gets shot. That takes us to the opening credits. Okay, so it's actually kind of nice having the cold open involve all of our major characters. It's a nice setup, maybe a bit cliched, but I'm okay with it. This episode won't really have a mystery to it. It's a moral dilemma episode. When we come back from the credits, we're at the hospital. Nat and Nick are in Richard's room, and he appears to be in a coma. It's a nice, dramatic scene. It's well acted. I gotta give Catherine Disher some credit. I think she's probably the best actor on the main cast, honestly. The dialogue itself is a bit much, but you know what? She sells it. We learn Richard is married and has a daughter who are on their way. "Only the good die young," says Nat. To Nick, no less. She asks Nick to leave so she can be with her brother. We dissolve cut to the wife being there sometime later. The wife, named Sarah, and Nat talk about the reality of if Richard doesn't pull through. And the daughter comes into the room asking, "When is Daddy going to wake up?" You know, to really up the pathos for us. I notice the child actor is overdubbed, and I kind of wonder about her performance. Throughout the story, this whole episode, they'll talk about Richard's daughter like she's a baby, but she's clearly an adolescent. She's nearly as tall as the mother. So we cut from that to the station. Nick and Skanky are talking about the Craven case. The witness, who wanted immunity, isn't exactly trusting of the cops after witnessing a shootout in the station. Back at the hospital, Nick talks to a still unconscious Richard when Nick comes in. He offers to take Natalie home. But Richard comes too. He starts talking, very faintly, weakly. He's not out of the woods yet. Flashback time. A woman is stealing food from some fisherman's hut on the beach. The fishermen catch her and demand payment, which is pretty clearly a rape threat. So yeah, they're bad guys. In wrestling with her, it's revealed that she's a leper. And then they immediately stab her. Jesus, what the fuck? I have no idea exactly what time frame this flashback's supposed to be. The synopsis says it's England. The clothing doesn't look medieval, really. But fuck, the main fisherman goes from "I'm gonna rape you" to "stabby stab" in like 0 seconds flat. The woman is left for dead on the beach. Back in present time in the lair, Nick is playing his piano. He falls back into memory, where he comes across the woman who was stabbed, and we hear Natalie's voice over the memory, "I need to talk to you." She's there in the lair, sobbing. "It's not fair. Richard doesn't deserve to die." Nick embraces her. "There's only one person who can save him," Natalie says. "Leave it in God's hands," Nick barely whispers it. "God made a mistake this time. Only you can fix it," Natalie replies. And this is such a good scene. There's a lot of drama without it crossing over too far. Just a really nice scene between Nick and Nat. That drama takes us to the commercial break and sunrise over Toronto. So let's pause here to consider some of the ideas that are being brought up in this episode. Continually, we will be told that Richard is a good man, quote-unquote, and that his death isn't fair or deserved. Now, for most of us mere mortals, this is a painful truth. One way we either learn to accept in one way or another, or we live our brief lives in anguish. But in Forever Night, there's a possible so-called solution being brought across as a vampire. The assumption being that Nick is also a good man, so Richard can still be one too. Now, as I've mentioned in previous episode, we don't know anything about Nick's life before he was turned, other than he was in the Crusades. We actually have no idea if he was a good moral man or not while he was living. But let's consider the broader question, what does it mean to be a good man? Existentialist philosophy is atheistic, with a few notable exceptions. So how do we make an appeal to ethical living without the recourse of relying on a god as a source for what is good? For Simone de Beauvoir and other writers, The absence of God puts responsibility for finding meaning in life squarely on our shoulders. Evil is, for Beauvoir, the denial of freedom. Drawing upon Sartre's notion of freedom as being the kind of radical, individual, subjective freedom at the moment of the present choice, de Beauvoir deepens our understanding of the conditions of our freedom. We are radically free, yes, but we are always in a situation which limits the possibilities of our freedom in very specific ways. We can be alienated from our freedom. We have bodies. Our bodies are raced, gendered, they age, they can be harmed by disease or violence. We can be physically and mentally oppressed and abused. In these ways, our radical freedom is bound. However, when we deny our freedom by saying something is God's will, for example, by refusing to take responsibility of the choices we have and make within our situation, we are living in bad faith. When we do the same against others, to oppress or willfully limit the bounds of their subjective experience, we are committing an act of evil. For Beauvoir, I cannot affirm my freedom without also affirming the freedom of others. Ethical behavior has its basis in recognizing the freedom and dignity of others, and understanding that it is through their recognition of the same in me that I can then also be totally free. We are bodies that house subjectivities, and these bodies are always shaped by and constrained by others. We can be existentially ethical by acknowledging that, as Beauvoir writes in Pyrrhus and Cineas, quote, I am the face of the other's misery, end quote, and thus take responsibility for how our choices and actions shape other people's reality. In this episode, Natalie asks, pleads, for Nick to save her brother from death. Her justification is that Richard is a good man, undeserving of an early demise. Now, we can probably see from the outset she's making a logical fallacy here. There's nothing we can draw upon that would indicate that being good or decent person entitles one to a long life. But, of course, she isn't making a logical appeal. She's making an emotional one. You don't know what you're asking, Nick warns. Natalie claps back hard at Nick. Nick is alive, she says. You have feelings. You have friends. You have a life. You're human, she pleads. But Nick is adamant. I'm not human. This isn't a life. But Natalie persists. I've seen you hold a crucifix. I've helped you, and I can help Richard. I won't relay the entire back and forth of the scene because it's actually really good. Catherine Disher is on point. Geraint Wyn-Davies is good. Just watch the episode. Ultimately, Nick says his life is worse than death, which Natalie takes affront to. She says if it's that bad, just kill yourself then. She grabs the remote that opens the sun blinds, but Nick stops her, and she begs one more time. In this scene, Nick is arguing from the point that becoming a vampire inevitably destroys one's humanity, whereas Natalie is taking the stance that if Nick can be brought back closer to humanity, given all the centuries of his condition, then Richard can be saved because he'll be indoctrinated and treated from the very outset of becoming a vampire. Natalie assumes that Richard's morality will survive his transition intact. Natalie assumes, like I think most of us do, that morality is a matter of individual character. A person is either moral or not. Now, let me say I've been a little sloppy with my language so far here. Let me clarify. Morals and ethics are not exactly the same thing. Briefly, we can say that morality is something considered individual, whereas ethics is something considered socially or communally, both having to do with concepts of right and wrong. So Natalie assumes Richard's morality will cause him to continue to act ethically even after he is transformed, because she sees these things as being both connected and essential to individual character. Now, if you've been paying attention to this podcast at all, then you can probably figure out that the existentialists don't think anything is really inherent to our character, other than maybe existential dread. Richard, when he is transformed, will undergo a radical change of his embodied situation, the conditions of his being, of his self, of his freedom, will be fundamentally altered. As we see, spoilers, this changes both his basis for morality and his choice of ethics. He will become violent, oppressive, and cruel. Back into the episode, we're in a flashback. Nick rescues the leper on the beach. Her name is Elizabeth. She begs for death initially and asks him to give her a decent burial. But Nick offers immortality. He seems quite genuine in his offer, compassionate even. We cut to the Raven, modern times, snarling vampires, and of course, Jeanette. There's music playing in the scene, and I didn't recognize it at first until Jeanette and Nick start talking. It's The Night Calls My Name, the song from the montage in episode 6. He asks Jeanette if she ever brought someone over. She admits she's never been able to stop herself from killing. She's never been able to stop feeding on a person before they died to bring them across. She encourages Nick to let Richard die, to not go through with his plan. Nick says, "I can control my urges." But we, the audience, feel that Nick's urge to kill isn't really what's at stake here. We get a little bit of lore. When a vampire brings across another, Jeanette tells us, there is an eternal bond between the two. Nick dismisses this, says he doesn't believe that. It comes across like he thinks it's almost like a superstition, which is a little weird to me. Jeanette brings up, what about Lacroix, following you through the centuries? Nick says Lacroix wanted to control him, make him like Lacroix. Jeanette says he was your father, your creator. He loved you. That's an interesting thought. Fodder for a different conversation, maybe. Back at the station, Nick is talking to Skanky about the Craven case. And I actually like that the police stuff is the B-plot in this episode. I mean, I watch Forever Night for the vampire drama, not the legal stuff. And you can see episode 7 for my reasons why. Back at the hospital, a doctor is talking to Nat about Richard's declining condition. And I realize I'm an old woman because I think the doctor looks like he's 12 years old. The doctor's direct. Richard is not going to make it. They have no way of knowing exactly how long he has, but he's dying. The doctor's delivery isn't very good, which is a shame because Catherine Disher is bringing it. And I'm sorry if I'm coming across as a fangirl, but she's really good in this episode. Nick arrives in time for a flashback. Nick makes the dying woman, Elizabeth, swear to do as he instructs before bringing her across. Back in the present, Natalie begs one last time and Nick hesitates. Richard starts flatlining. Nick does what we knew he was going to do. The drama ramps up to the commercial break. Side note, where's Richard's wife? This whole scene, it's just Natalie and Nick in the room with Richard. Where's Sarah? Why is she not by his bedside? I mean, we all deal with tragedy and death in our own way. It's just, if my husband were dying, even if he was totally unresponsive, there would have to be a fucking firing squad at the door to keep me away from him in his last moments. Honestly, I kind of wish they didn't have the wife and daughter in the story. They really seem just tacked on to make Richard's story seem more tragic. As though a young man being gunned down in his prime wasn't sad enough without him leaving behind a grieving mother and child. Anyway, back from the break, Richard is flatlined, and Natalie at first thinks Nick has killed him, but then Richard wakes up, and he has a heartbeat? Do vampires have heartbeats in this universe? He quickly flatlines again, and Nick explains he'll have a heartbeat about once every 10 minutes. Huh. Okay. Nat, of course, is overjoyed. But a nurse comes in, and Nat has to check herself so it doesn't look like she's happy that her brother died. They have to do some fancy talking to get Richard's body out of the hospital ASAP. Nat uses her credentials as a forensic pathologist, and Nick uses his police badge, and I get it, they have to get Richard out, like, immediately. But the scene is strange, almost comical in how quickly it comes on the heels of the previous scene. I don't know. I guess if they had not have had the scene, I'd be complaining that they didn't explain how they got Richard out. But I don't know that the way they handled it does the plot any favors. We're about halfway through the episode at this point, just for reference. We cut to Nick's lair. Sarah's there, and they're explaining to her that Richard's not really dead. They're explaining the whole vampire thing, which, of course, she's quite incredulous, to say the least. Richard awakens, and Nick advises Nat and Sarah to leave so he can deal with him. Flashback. Elizabeth is now a vampire, totally healed, of course. She's practically drunk with her newfound power. Back in the present, Richard awakens. "I'm hungry," he says. Nick gives him a bottle, cow's blood, probably. Richard seems reasonable at the moment. He asks what's going to happen. Flashback to Nick being brought over by Lacroix, and then quickly back with Richard. Nick lays it out for him. No sunlight, no garlic, no crucifixes, and so on. Richard seems overwhelmed and a little incredulous, but he still seems rational. He's still a good man. Nick warns Richard that his urges will always threaten to overpower him, so he can't see his family just yet. We flash back again. Elizabeth has hunted down the fishermen who attacked her and has killed them. Back in the present, Nick leaves Richard. Wait, what? Why the fuck is Nick just leaving him? I mean, sure, okay, Richard is acting all calm and reasonable for the moment, but really, Nick? Why? So, after Nick leaves, Richard goes downstairs and he calls his wife, Sarah. And he tells her that he loves her and he wants to see her. It's a nice scene, and it reminds us that Richard still has a lot of humanity. And I do like the actor playing Richard. He has a lot of emotional work to do in a very short period of time, and I think he handles it well. At the station, Nick arrives. Craven is going to walk because the witness won't come forward now. Back at the lair, Richard is listening to news about murder and crime on the radio, and I think you know where this is going. At the station, Natalie comes in. Skanky offers flowers and condolences for the death of her brother. And I wish Natalie was better prepared to act like a grieving sister. She seems surprised at the gesture, and it just seems a little out of place for what we know about her character. I feel like she would know to play the part better. After the scene, Skanky is a little weirded out about Nat's reaction. It's brief, but I like it. It shows that Skanky's not an idiot. He notices when Nick, and in this case, when Nat, are acting a little off. Meanwhile, Richard is flying around Toronto. He comes across an assault in progress, and he quickly kills the assailant. Out on the streets in the caddy, Skanky and Nick are talking. Skanky talks about how Natalie was moving on from her brother's death so quickly. It turns into a conversation about how death is inevitable. It's the way of the world, how things are supposed to be, Skanky says. A radio call comes in. 81 Kilo is the caddy's call sign. Cool. I feel like I'm learning a lot in this episode. They're called to the crime scene. The woman is panicked, saying the man who killed her attacker did it with his teeth. Dun dun dun. Commercial break. We come back from commercial at the station. We learn that someone, Richard, has killed 3 people in 3 hours. Vicious, brutal killings. He's mainly targeting drug dealers, petty criminals, interrupting assaults, and so on. Meanwhile, Nick is at the Raven, asking Jeanette if any of the brood there is responsible. And Jeanette says everyone there is on their best behavior. Of course, Nick knows it's Richard. Maybe he's hoping it isn't, looking for Jeanette to give him something else. The scene does give us a slight glimpse into the vampire culture. The Raven is obviously a hangout, a center for the vampire community. Jeanette seems to be a leader and has some control over it. She's mad at Nick for not controlling his creation. If Richard's gone rogue, it could threaten all of them. Meanwhile, Craven has captured the witness and is threatening to kill her. Richard enters dramatically at that point. We cut to Nick and his caddy, who has a flashback. Elizabeth says she only wants revenge. We come back to the present. Nick finds the hideout and Richard's bloody aftermath. All the goons are dead, and the witness also, her neck bitten. Which tells us Richard isn't just a marauding vigilante. He's a monster now. So let's consider a few things at this point. We see that Richard's changed condition has indeed corrupted, if you will, his morality. No surprise. I mean, if he'd stayed a good guy, it wouldn't be a very interesting episode, would it? But we see Richard become a beast to his will. Without going into Nietzsche's idea of the will to power again, although I think we will revisit that in the future, we see Richard, imbued with his newfound condition, shift his moral center to one of domination and oppression. He becomes a tyrant, an executioner, using the particulars of his condition to exert control and destruction over others, denying their freedom and ultimately his own. This is necessarily an unethical position, which denies the autonomy and freedom of others. In other words, he's a murderous asshole. No argument there. Simone de Beauvoir writes, quote, "A freedom which is interested only in denying freedom must be denied. And it is not true that the recognition of freedom of others limits my own freedom. To be free is not to have the power to do anything you like. It is to be able to surpass the given towards an open future. The existence of others as a freedom defines my situation, and it is even the condition of my own freedom." End quote. Ultimately, it is our finitude, our mortality, that puts pressure on our condition and urges us to take a stance, to call out, to make connections with others. To find dignity and meaning in my life is necessarily, for de Beauvoir, to recognize the same in others. Living a life without such really isn't living, or at least it's an inauthentic life. Ends do not justify the means in this ethical standing. There is no justification to be found in a future that does not yet exist. Only the present condition in our projects of liberation are what matter. When Richard says he's above the scum he has killed, or when Jeanette, for that matter, reminds Nick, as she's done in multiple episodes, that they are above these humans around them, they act in bad faith. They deny their finitude and their interconnectedness to the others that surround them. Because here's the deal. Vampires are not truly immortal. They are potentially immortal. But we've seen vampires die on the show. And we've seen them fear death as much, if not actually more, than they seem to fear a meaningless parade of endless nights. The future is just as uncertain and indeterminable for Nick and Jeanette as it is for Natalie and Skanky. being transformed into vampires, has not reconciled their human condition, only prolonged it. They do not exist disconnected, either. They must feed, for one. But they also rely on the systems and infrastructure of the human world for shelter and protection. They are interconnected to each other as much as they are the human world they pretend to transcend. Back at the lair, Nick has brought Natalie to explain what Richard has become. Richard is there, of course. We're closing in on the end of the episode, so we need to have our final confrontation. The wife, Sarah, also comes in for some reason. Now, I won't recount all the details of what happens, but there's a fight. Richard fights Nick and throws him around a bit. The cross we saw in episode 3 comes back out. Richard presses Nick's face against it, and later Natalie uses it to ward Richard off. Ultimately, Nick does get the upper hand. He stakes Richard and shoves him into the sunlight, where he disintegrates. About violence, by the way, Simone de Beauvoir is a realist on this. Violence is an unavoidable and tragic aspect of the human condition. Violence is not always evil, though. Sometimes to liberate the oppressed, we must destroy the oppressor. We bear the weight of that responsibility of our choice. That brings us to wrap-up time. Nick is doing a mind whammy on Sarah, explaining that there are no such things as vampires. Richard died in the hospital. What she thinks she saw was only a nightmare. And in the flashback, Nick destroyed his creation by shoving her into a fire, but he did give her the burial she wanted. And that's the end. So, wow. There was a lot happening in this one. I want to address something quickly here. Kind of a fan geek discussion. So I know that a lot of Forever Night fans get upset that Nick was being bested by a newbie vampire. Honestly, I don't see that as controversial in the context of the episode. Richard had been feasting on human blood just before that fight and was probably feeling very powerful. Whereas Nick hasn't had human blood in a very long time, and it's been heavily implied that his regaining of humanity has come with a severe lessening of his vampire powers. So yeah, Richard would have been stronger than him. I get it. What I don't get is why in the fuck Nick would have left this guy alone all day. I mean, just call into work or something. Stay in the lair to keep Richard at bay. That's what didn't make sense to me. So my impressions of this episode. This is a fan favorite, and for good reason. It was really good. It expands the Forever Night universe lore on vampires for us. It gives us some great drama. It gives us some indication about why Nick and Jeanette don't have their own brood of vampires following them around. And it shows us how vampirism pretty much immediately destroys one's humanity and basis for morality. All the main actors were on point, especially Catherine Disher, who I've gushed over already. The secondary characters were also pretty good, which is not always the case on this show. I'll give credit to the actor playing Richard. He had a very short period of time to make us feel Richard's humanity and understand how his pursuit of justice could be warped into a murderous rage. And he did so in a way that still felt grounded and genuine. The fight at the end felt a bit rushed, I'll say by way of criticism. And because Nick is our hero, I mean, there was really no tension that Richard was going to win. But that's really more of a product of episodic television writing than a fault of this episode itself. In a different kind of series, written in a different time, maybe Richard would have escaped and morphed into some kind of reoccurring villain. But that's not Forever Night, really. All around, great episode. I suppose someone might wonder if this would be a good episode for someone who is unfamiliar with the franchise to watch if they hadn't seen any other episodes. While I think you could certainly follow the plot, I think such a person would have a lot of questions about Nick's motivations. So much of Nick's reasoning was based on his close relationship with Natalie. If a person wasn't familiar with that dynamic, they might not get why Nick would ever agree to bring Richard across. So far as we've seen, this makes two times that Nick has brought someone across, and in both cases, he was unable to control his creation and had to destroy them. We've also seen Nick stalked by his own creator, Lacroix, pressing Nick to become the killer Elizabeth and Richard became, and then Nick turning against him, destroying him. Nick has been patricidal and infanticidal, at least in vampire terms. He's destroyed his lineage and his inheritors. Is there something Freudian about that? I'm not sure. I also quite enjoyed reading more Simone de Beauvoir. For this episode, I read the entirety of The Ethics of Ambiguity, which I had only kind of cherry-picked from in previous episodes. It's a really good book, really interesting, and I look forward to exploring de Beauvoir's works more in the future. I think we can learn a lot from what she has to say. Next week, my friends, we watch episode 10 of season 1, entitled Dead Air, in which Nick and Skanky hunt a serial killer. So tune in, gentle listener, next week to Still Dreaming, an existentialist wandering through our forever night. Do you want to connect with Still Dreaming? You can find us on Instagram at Still Dreaming Podcast and on Twitter at podcast_still. And we have a group on Facebook. Just look up Still Dreaming Podcast. Would you like to help support the show? Donation buttons can be found on our website, stilldreamingpodcast.wordpress.com. Let's pause for a word from our sponsor. Still Dreaming is a podcast hosted and recorded by me in the newly revamped CERK Internet Radio Studio. Forever Night was produced for CBS by Glenn Warren Productions and Sony Pictures Television. All rights reserved.